From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artists tonight for the first couple hours. Their full information at the coasttocoastam.com website. Great artists, by the way. Later on tonight, we'll talk about your luck. Here's what's happening. Things are tense in North and South Korea. South Korea's military has now conducted a live fire exercise simulating an attack on a nuclear site to strongly warn North Korea in response to the rogue nation's apparent nuke test. A surface-to-surface missile and long-range air-to-ground missiles accurately struck targets in the Sea of Japan. It is indeed getting tense. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis has vowed a massive military response to any threat from North Korea against the United States or its allies in a statement outside the White House after a meeting with President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and top national security advisors. That was done today. And President Trump has suggested, after another underground nuke test by North Korea, that he'll stop all trade with any country doing business with the rogue nation. After Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said that he is drafting sanctions in a package that would end all trade with North Korea as well. Charles R. Smith has been with us really since this tenseness has begun, and I want to get his opinion on the latest episodes here, Charlie. Give me your reaction on just what's happening right now.
Well, it's apparent that Kim Jong-un took a trip to south of the border and picked himself up a couple of M-80s. Basically, I believe we mentioned before there's quite large likelihood that he's going to be popping off a couple of nukes in there as a test.
Yep, you saw that.
It was about the equivalent of one of our early tests called Ivy Mike. It's a enhanced or boosted A-bomb, probably not an H-bomb. We won't know until the WC-135 sniffer aircraft comes back with the test results, because H-bomb explosions, even if they're done underground, still yield very significant isotopes that can be picked up by very sensitive equipment, especially at high altitude by our aircraft. So we've got to wait a couple of days for the actual verdict to come in. The size, around 100 kilotons, again, suggests a boosted A-bomb design.
And Charlie, you've been saying since the beginning of all this tension that we will not have military conflict. And as of right now, are you still sticking to that?
Absolutely.
All right, let's hope you're right. That's the least thing we need right now, to be sure. Charles R. Smith. China, meanwhile, has strongly condemned North Korea's nuclear test, slamming it for ignoring international condemnation of its atomic weapons program. The United Nations will meet on Monday about this situation. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, what's the significance of China condemning North Korea for this test?
Well, I don't think there's really much significance at all to it, George, because China's been doing that. They voted for sanctions on August 5th. They've pushed back today and made some statement that the U.S., this China containment theory is outrageous. How can they possibly expect China to dissuade North Korea no matter what they do, no matter what economic sanctions or other kinds of leverage they apply to them? So I think that, you know, the issue is not really the blast dimensions of the nuclear test. A lot of people are hung up on this right now, which is it a thermonuclear, a fusion bomb, or is it just another A-bomb? It really doesn't matter at this point. We know the kind of damage at Nagasaki and Hiroshima that an A-bomb can produce.
That's right.
So quibbling over whether it's a thermonuclear device or an A-bomb device is not the issue. Trump has set a red line in this situation. He has said he will not permit North Korea to develop a nuclear-ready intercontinental ballistic missile. They are on the threshold of getting that. If they don't have it already. So I think the idea that, you know, was mentioned, I think, in an exit interview on some network by Stephen Bannon, that this was all, you know, the fire and fury statements earlier in the month were all a bluff on Trump's part. I don't think they're a bluff. I think you've heard at least on two or three occasions now from the defense secretary that the U.S. will take forceful and massive action against North Korea. The idea that somehow that we're protecting, I think, all protecting South Korea, you know, from a potential strike from North Korea is no longer the main consideration here. The consideration for the U.S., and you've been hearing this today by statements that Trump has made, that we cannot take the route of appeasement any longer. And the time of talking is basically over with. And then when asked by a reporter today whether he's going to order a strike on North Korea, he said, we'll see. So I think the military option is absolutely on the table. And I think that they know very well that with all the bluster and all the hype with North Korea's military and all their artillery pieces and all of their, you know, their saber rattling, that the U.S. can put them down. They can wipe them out very quickly, especially their military capability or capacity of their army to make any inroads in South Korea. So I think people, you know, really have to understand that Trump has set his red line, and he is not going to back down from that. And there's no indication with all of the talk at the UN and the Security Council going back into session and the condemnations, is there's zero enforcement by the UN on North Korea. And it's very clear now, and I think to almost everyone, that North Korea will not denuclearize. They will not give up their nuclear program. That is their leverage. And I think the only way that this maniac over there is going to be stopped is with a massive U.S. strike. So I think this nuclear test, whether it was thermonuclear, whether it was an A-bomb, is really less significant than this guy is getting dangerously close if, like you said, he doesn't already have a nuclear-tipped ICBM.
All right, Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Two separate views. You heard Charles R. Smith. He doesn't think there's going to be any intervention that way. Dr. Curtis believes that there will be. For 12,000 students in the Houston area, they could be sent to different schools because of the damage of then Hurricane Harvey. 53 of Houston's schools have major damage. At least 22 of the schools will be closed for months. Just a horrible tragedy there. A man who ran into the Burning Man's Festival signature burning of a tower effigy has died. He just got whacked out and went running right into the flames. Talking about flames, a wildfire on the northern edge of Los Angeles rapidly grew into what the mayor called the largest blaze in the city's history, prompting the evacuation of hundreds of people and closure of a major highway. The 5,000-plus acres of the La Tuna Fire, named after the canyon area where it erupted on Friday, has led authorities to evacuate more than 700 homes in the North Los Angeles neighborhood and in nearby Burbank and Glendale. Our own Tom Danheiser's close is somewhere close there. Tom, is your house safe?
Yeah, my house is safe. Three homes have been destroyed, but weather did assist today. The firefighters made significant progress in one of the biggest fires to hit the Los Angeles area. 5,985 acres have been burnt so far. 1,000-plus firefighters battling this fire. Now, there's still work to be done, but about 90% of the people evacuated have returned to their homes. Evacuation has been lifted for the Burbank and Glendale areas.
Can you see the fire from your house?
Yes, I can. I can walk out in the backyard and see the flames.
What about the smell of smoke and stuff like
it's
that?
It's really thick, yes.
Okay, thank you, Tom, for that update. Okay. Walter Becker, the guitarist and co-founder of the band Steely Dan, has died. He was 67 years old. No announcement of what caused his death. Now, he had undergone a hospital procedure some time ago, but they had said that he will be fine very soon. Obviously not. He has missed a couple of their performances with the band. Walter Becker, co-founder of Steely Dan, dead at the age of 67. Police are warning residents of a Chicago suburb to avoid helping zombie dogs because they are infected with coyotes that could sicken other pets with disease. So watch out there, folks. The battle for artificial intelligence expertise is now forcing Apple to grapple with its famous penchant for secrecy as tech companies seek to woo talent in a discipline known for its openness. The technology giant this year has been trying to draw attention, but only so much, to its efforts to develop artificial intelligence. But it looks like they have to be a little more public for what they're trying to do. And next week, of course, Apple will unveil its new iPhone. Lauren Weinstein, the expert on the Internet, with us. This new phone that's coming out with Apple, how important is it for them, Lauren?
You know, I'm sitting here wondering, you know, if we stop trading with China because, you know, they're North Korea's primary trading partner, and if the North Koreans attack South Korea, where a lot of the tech comes from, we may not have a new iPhone to worry about here.
If we assume
that these horrible things don't happen and there actually are new iPhones, there's another problem. I don't know about you. I find it's getting harder and harder to get too excited about these new smartphone releases. It's like the pattern has been set, and now we're sort of, you know, nibbling around the edges of new features. Different kind of fingerprint ID, different kind of visual face ID. The rumor at least, is that the new iPhone will have a wireless charging system that may be incompatible with everybody else's wireless charging systems. New emphasis on virtual reality applications and things. Apparently, a higher price, of course.
Of course.
So people kind of have, you know, more and more people, I think, are kind of stopping and saying, well, is there a value in me for me in upgrading these as often as maybe I have in the past? I tend to hold on to, you know, I mostly use Android phones, and I tend to hold on to them until they slow down to the point where they're just not working anymore.
But as long as you don't have a flip phone anymore, right?
Yeah, no, I did get rid of my flip phone some years ago, though I must admit they certainly had that Star Trek ambiance, right?
I mean,
for Apple, this is a very important,
of
very
course,
important, you know, thing, right? Because so much of their whole ecosystem is based on this. I think really when people look at smartphones now, the important thing to consider is not the phone itself, but what's behind the phone, right? Are you more interested in having a phone that's that works with Siri, or are you more interested in having an Android phone that works with Google Assistant?
That's right.
It's not just a phone, is really a terminal more than anything else, and it's that big, vast infrastructure behind it in those data centers that really gives the phone its value. So I think that's a good way to look at it.
And it's really now a handheld computer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely a handheld computer. In fact, the power in one of these phones now is basically equivalent to all the computing power and storage capacity of the early ARPANET. So technology does march onward.
It sure does. Lauren, thanks so much. Love your perspective on all this. Up next, science and the supernatural. Kind of bends together, doesn't it? We're going to be talking with Jim Willis, Supernatural Gods, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a fascinating couple hours with Jim Willis. After graduating from the Eastman School of Music, Jim became a high school band and orchestra teacher during the week and a symphony trombonist on the weekends, a jazz musician at night, and a choral conductor on Sunday mornings. He's the author of 9 books on religion and spirituality. He's been an ordained minister for more than 40 years while working part-time as a woodworker and handyman. What a career. And his latest book is called Supernatural Gods, Spiritual Mysteries, Psychic Experiences, and Scientific Truth. Jim, this is amazing. You've done just about everything.
Well, I don't know. George, hearing you talk about it makes it sound pretty exciting, but it didn't seem that way going along.
Hey, I love jazz, and it's still pretty strong in this country, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, there's a great jazz scene, and the only thing for a guy like me who's, you know, been around for a long time is to hear these young kids coming up, and they are so scary what they can do. Really some great, great jazz musicians coming up. I was, before I came out here to the woods of South Carolina, about 8 years ago, I was down just south of Daytona Beach, And we had a lot of retired jazz musicians down there, so there was a big jazz scene. And whenever we get together and play, we'd always be talking about the latest phenom we heard somewhere. It's a tremendous thing going on in the country, that's for sure.
It sure is. Now, tell me, with this background you have in music and as a minister, how did you get involved in talking about supernatural gods and issues like that?
I met a nude woman on a rock.
Excuse me, Jimmy? A nude woman on a rock?
What? A nude woman on a rock, yeah. What happened? I was...
better than a snake that comes out under the rock.
I guess I better explain that.
When I was converted
to Christianity, I had a classic conversion, and I became a fundamentalist Christian who evolved into an evangelical Christian and a charismatic Christian and later a middle-of-the-road Christian and then a liberal Christian. But it was all involved, of course, in Christianity. I was a member of the clergy. And it's hard for some people to understand if they're not involved in that world. But when you are an evangelical Christian, such as I was, you develop a systematic theology that's based upon a literal historical interpretation of the Bible. And so without realizing, you fall into this terrible trap. You don't begin to preach about God as much as you begin to preach about the Bible. And of course, whenever that happens, if you can prove anywhere to your satisfaction that the Bible perhaps should not be read historically because there may be historical inaccuracies, and or it should not be read literally because there are contradictions within its pages, if that happens, then your whole theology falls apart. And if your theology falls apart, your God falls apart. And that's what happened to me. I was sitting at my desk one day getting ready for a sermon, and I was doing it my normal way. I was getting together all these proof texts from Scripture and thinking that I've got a bludgeon my congregation over the head with all these proof tests to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt my own views, my own religious views and everything else, when all of a sudden all of the things that I had feared and swept under the rug about this particular interpretation of the Bible, they all came and they just grabbed hold of me and shook me and would not let me go, and my whole theology fell apart.
Well, you've mixed it together well with this book, Supernatural Gods.
Well, what happened? This was many years ago, but what happened was, as I sat there, I thought I was going to have to leave the ministry because I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't believe it anymore, and that's a terrible thing to be in. And you'd be surprised how many clergy out there in that situation, but still hang on. Well, I couldn't do that. I had to get it straightened out in my head, so I decided to go on a self-imposed retreat. And I went up to a little log cabin that I had built up in the woods of New Hampshire. And while I was up there, I didn't want to see anybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I just wanted to think. I just wanted to be. I felt totally alone, totally crushed. My whole philosophy, my theology had just fallen apart. About the second or third day into this, I decided I was going to go on a hike. I needed a good hard hike. And out behind the log cabin, there was a mountain that I've climbed a number of times before. And it was going to serve my purposes beautifully this day because I could go up this mountain. It was a hard climb. Get to the top, and it's a gorgeous view you can see forever. And I thought, this is just what I need today. And most important, I had never seen anybody up there before, ever. So I thought, here we go. This is a good thing to do. So I took off in the morning, and about 2 hours, I climbed this mountain and made my way to the top. And I was just got to the tree line. I was about to step out into the clearing at the top of this mountain. And just as I stepped out of the woods, there in the middle of the clearing was a nude woman sunbathing on a rock. Now, you have no idea.
An epiphany.
Epiphany. You have no idea how scary it is for a conservative, fundamentalist evangelical minister to see such unmitigated horror as a nude woman on a rock sunbathing.
Oh, poor you.
I was sure my...
It would have been my luck to see a turtle or a frog.
I was sure my entire congregation was going to come out of the woods and accuse me, you know, of something and everything else.
Some horrendous thing. Hold on, Jim. We're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, let's get into the specifics of these supernatural gods and how you tie it into psychic experiences. Our special guest, Jim Willis, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back with him. And then we're going to take calls with Jim next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Willis with us. We're talking about his latest work, Supernatural Gods. And tell us, Jim, how you bridge the difference between supernatural, spiritual, psychic experiences that are all in the book.
Well, it began with that woman I was telling you about. I got up there, and she invited me to come over and join her. And normally, I didn't talk to strangers along these things. She was just fascinated about life, and she started talking about all these things that were off limits for a fundamentalist, conservative, evangelical type minister. She was talking about reincarnation. She was talking about extrasensory perception. She was talking about crystals. And even more important, she started asking me, what do you believe and why? And she didn't criticize, she didn't judge, she was just really fascinated by it.
Now, did she put her clothes on when she was doing all this, or what?
No, she didn't.
And this was a life-sized person. This wasn't like a little tiny fairy or something.
No, this was a real person, although I must say, on every second Tuesday, I wonder, angels unaware and all that kind
you
of
never
thing.
Know.
I don't know. But I realized this was the first real spiritual discussion I was having with somebody in years. And I walked down off that mountain, opened all of a sudden to new ideas. And, of course, being a kind of a left-brain intellectual type approach to everything, I began a real systematic study of reality and discovered that science and religion had been on two separate roads for a long time, and these roads were beginning to merge. And it's only become more so in the last 20 years since I had this experience. If you want to really hear the voice of the prophet now, you don't listen to the pulpit as much as you listen to the professors out of MIT talking about this wild and wacky world of you know, the quantum reality. And the more I began to study that world, the more I began to see the underlying pinnings of what reality really was, the more I began to think that all of our religious mythology was stemming from a time when people, the ancients, I'm talking thousands of years ago, intuited these things, which we are now beginning to understand scientifically with our minds. And the two highways, I think, of the science behind the undergirding reality and the religious mythology that has described that reality in so many different ways are now beginning to come together. I think it's an exciting time to live. I think humankind is right on the edge of a great, great step. If we don't destroy ourselves,
well, I was just going to say that.
Years ahead.
Yeah. If we don't destroy ourselves, it could be a marvelous planet, to be sure.
You know, I was thinking about this. I was listening to the news you had at the beginning of the show, talking about Korea and talking about fires and talking about floods and all this kind of thing. That's a very real world. Obviously, it surrounds us. And as I'm listening to that, I'm sitting on my porch in South Carolina right now. It's about 1:30 in the morning or so. It's a beautiful moonlit night. I'm listening to coyotes howling in the distance.
I can hear them in the distance.
Yeah, and the dogs are going to start up now pretty quick because they're going to hear the coyotes. And I look at this, and I'm just surrounded by peace and beauty, and yet I'm hearing what's going on in the world. These two worlds are right side by side right now. And I think it's just symbolic. Humans are at yet another crossroads. We've been here a lot of times before, but we never had the dangerous toys we do now.
And unfortunately, you cannot separate the two worlds, Jim, because they mesh.
Absolutely. And it's a wonderful thought and a frightening thought at the same time, isn't it?
It sure is. Are you convinced that the supernatural realm exists beyond a shadow of a doubt? Whatever it may be, which could include the afterlife, psychic experiences, all things like that?
That is more real to me than what most people call reality, to be honest. I think what we see as reality is really, as the ancient Hindus used to say, it's an illusion. Nothing is as it seems to be. Underpinning this reality in which we live, that quite frankly, it seems real to us because we've evolved in it with five senses to make sense out of it. And these five senses serve us very well in a day-to-day normal activity. But the five senses are filters. As well as letting things in, they also filter other things out. And I'm convinced that underneath what we call reality is a deeper reality, the actual reality of energy and the quantum world. It all stems from what I call the source, through the field that the ancient Hindus used to call the Akashic field. And it's the sense of all potential, that seething energy. So when we look around us right now, we see telephones and we hear coyotes in the distance. We see chairs and we talk on watch televisions and things like that. That's really not the reality. It is a seething cloud of energy that appears so real to us. But it's only the superficial part underneath the reality. That's where the rubber meets the road to me.
You had an out-of-body experience. Tell us about that.
I've had many, actually. I studied out-of-body experiences when I began having them kind of accidentally. I began to go about in a systematic way, studying with William Buhlman at the Monroe Institute in Virginia. And he teaches a particular technique that was very, very influential for me. I can't say that I can just go out of body whenever I want, but I have had many out-of-body experiences and seen things that are very difficult to explain. A shaman friend of mine says that when you go on a shamanic journey, when you go on an out-of-body journey, you're going to a place where language is inadequate, and then you're coming back to try to explain it with language that's insufficient. But I think if all of us can learn to see the world through something other than the five senses, through that sixth sense, I like to call it the first sense, actually, intuition and all that, and if we can actually separate our consciousness from the filters, the filtered stuff that comes through our five senses, we can begin to catch glimpses of real reality, the reality underneath, the energy of which all of these things that we see are just a superficial.
Well, this OBE that you had, though, was it accidental or did you manipulate it yourself?
The first one was accidental. Matter of fact, the first few were accidental. I didn't know what was happening.
Right.
And, of course, I thought, being new to it, I thought I was the only person that this had ever happened to. And so I began to question it and read about it and talk to people, and I began to understand that it's really a relatively common phenomenon.
I had one when I was 11, but I can't duplicate it. I've tried, but it was that out-of-body experience that fueled my hunger for this genre of the unknown.
Yeah.
And I went to the library and found a book called Projections of the Astral Body by Hayward Carrington and Sylvan Muldoon. And I was hooked. I was obsessed, actually, Jim, with all this. And
it can become an obsession, that's for sure.
Yeah.
The older I get now, the more I realize I used to say I live with one foot in that reality and one foot in this reality, but I'm beginning to edge more and more toward that other reality. It can be very difficult. When you say you tried to duplicate it, that's a difficult thing. Probably the biggest trap of meditation is try to duplicate an experience like that.
And I've studied from the best, you know, Robert Monroe and so many other people, but there's a block with me or something. Now, the one that I had at 11 was unexpected, like your first one.
Yeah.
I was bouncing it on the top of the ceiling, looking down at my body.
Yeah.
And it was a split second. I realized, oh my gosh, what is this? And when you do that, somehow the conscious and subconscious pull themselves together, and it rammed me back into my body with such a jolt. I didn't know what it was. But then, you know, I realized this wasn't a dream. This was too clear. to Absolutely. Be, you know, in a dream, you know how it's got that foggy little memory to it. But this mm-hmm. was, this was like, you know, seen, you know, in real time.
Yeah, yeah. Learning to control that, learning to be not surprised when it happens, learning to go with it and flow with it, that's probably the key to the craft of the out-of-body experience. And it's difficult, and it takes so much discipline. I find that I need to put forth the time every day and really go. And, of course, weeks go by and nothing happens. But then all of a sudden there's a shift, and you know, something is happening. And then the key is to go with it and not say, oh boy, this is great, what's going to happen? And boom, you're right smack back in this reality again.
Tell us about your experiences as a minister with your thought and belief of life after death.
I get so frustrated sometimes because we live in a world where attention spans are growing shorter, and where people don't have the time, you know, just trying to make a living. They don't have the time to really delve into this, and it does take time. It does take getting away. And I have seen so many times, I've sat at the bedsides of people so many times who, 500, 600, 700 times, maybe this has happened to me, where I've done funerals and talk to people just before they die, and sometimes they die and then come back and tell stories of seeing the other side, near-death experiences. But I've never, in all of that time, found anybody who regretted the fact that they didn't make more money, they didn't have more possessions, they didn't. But I have seen constantly, over and over, the theme that I wish I had spent more time preparing for this particular moment. It's only at the end that we realize what we're dealing with. Most of us in this culture, I think, have a tendency to put off death, to think somehow it's never going to happen to us. And so we just put it aside because we've got other things to do. And then when it comes, we realize it's the most important moment of our life, and we weren't ready for it. And it's frustrating. It really is frustrating. I wish I sometimes could take the world by the scruff of the neck and shake it and say, wake up, because once you begin to do that, then nothing else is important. And once you've experienced what that reality can be like, nothing will ever be the same. It could change literally the way we live if we would only pay attention to it.
Jim Willis with us, his book, Supernatural Gods. He's got a number of books that he has written, by the way. Jim, where do people get your books, by the way?
Probably the easiest way is through Amazon. Supernatural Gods, it just came out Friday.
Great. Just type in your name, Jim Willis. They'll all pop up probably.
If you Google Jim Willis Ancient Gods or Jim Willis Supernatural Gods, it'll all come up. Otherwise, my website has links to them all at jimwillis.net, and that'll get you into all of it, plus the videos and everything else that I've done.
We'll take calls next hour with Jim, and if you've had a psychic experience, an OBE, or some other experience, share that with us. What do you think the afterlife is, Jim? What exactly is it?
I have to give you my opinion. I don't know if we can ever say exactly, because interpreting it...
It's different for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, and our words, our language holds us back, because our language was invented to describe things in this reality. But I picture it in the book, Supernatural Gods. I have a chapter where I show this pie chart that I've developed that kind of pictures my idea of it, of, I call it, a slice of reality. I picture life moving out from the source, what I call the source. The source is the intense potential and perfect quiet and perfect peace that is at the middle of it all. But the thing is, when you're in the middle of the source, when you're perfect unity, perfect peace, you can't have experience. And experience is everything, to be able to experience something. But as soon as you start to have an experience, you're not in perfect unity anymore, because my experience is different than your experience. And so we move out through from the source, through the Akashic field, that field of great potentiality where everything is possible, and where Plato talked about the idea of hoarseness rather than a horse. A horse is just a temporary thing. Hoarseness is the reality. And that horse nests or human nests or whatever we want to call it is there in Akasha. We move out from Akasha, we come into the field of energy. We move through the newly discovered Higgs field where energy takes on mass. Mm-hmm. And that's where we live, out here on the edge, so to speak. So when you ask what I think happens when we die, we go back on the same journey going the other way. The material reality that is manifested here falls apart on us. The body eventually decays, but the spirit, the soul, the essence, what the Hindus call Atman, remains the same. And we pass back in through those fields, and we carry the experience that we had out here on the edge, we carry that back to the source, where it's mixed with everybody else's experience until eventually everything that can be experienced is experienced. And the source will be complete. It will be fulfilled. Not just the philosophy of what's out there, but the experience of what's out there. We carry that.
Jim, how did the ancients have this understanding way before we did?
Oh, they did. I think they intuited it. The Hindus, for instance, talked about Brahman. They deliberately said, you cannot explain Brahman. Brahman is a place where language cannot go. But then they began to see that there is a way to understand Brahman, because they came up with the other concept, which is Atman, and the nearest human equivalent we have to that is the word soul, in English at least. And the wonderful thing about Hinduism, when it talked about Atman and Brahman, it said, thou art that. They intuited that within us is the essence of all that is, the essence of Brahman itself. They were brilliant. They were so far ahead of us. And now the quantum physicists are beginning to say the same thing, except they call it entanglement. The idea that everything is entangled, everything is one, and through string theory and through multiverse theory and everything else, they begin to see that out here on the edge is this great experiential school that we're all going through. And we can get back to, when we take back to that source, we take our experience with us. It's a wonderful idea, isn't it?
And you believe in a higher power, obviously.
Yes, but I don't know what to call it anymore. I hesitate to use the word God.
As a minister, you don't use the word God?
I usually don't, because the word God is so loaded with baggage. I can use the word God, and I know what I mean, but someone else hears me say it, and they don't know what they mean. And I find it very difficult.
But you believe there's something there.
Yeah, something that is far beyond thought. I think the Hindus are correct. You can't. Language doesn't go there. It doesn't explain it. So, in other words, the culture has stolen a perfectly good word, God, and I haven't found a good word to put in there yet.
All right, stay with us, Jim. We're going to come back in just a moment and take phone calls with you as we continue chatting about your latest work, Supernatural Gods, Spiritual Mysteries, Psychic Experiences, and Scientific Truths, right here on Coast to Coast AM. But share your psychic experience with us.